Hey, how you doing? Thanks for downloading the show. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio. My name is Eric. I'm your host of this eclectic DIY show. Today, my good friend Aaron and I are going to talk about my frustrations with no-till gardening, some inferior germination rates that I just learned about, and other cool gardening stuff, because it's almost time to garden, believe it or not. Right, Aaron?
You bet it is. Absolutely.
Do you have your basement full of seedlings yet?
Not yet. I just sowed my very first seeds a week ago now.
What are they?
Snapdragons was the first thing. So snapdragons and foxglove got sown a week ago, but I don't really have anything else. I have a spreadsheet. I don't really have anything else on the list until probably another, you know, beginning of March. And then mid-March is when things really kick into high gear.
Are snapdragons slow to grow, or you can put them out really early?
You can put them out really early. Oh. And they grow all year. That's why I really started liking them, is that they flower all the way till frost, and they just keep going, and I keep cutting flowers and they make more. So it's great for bouquets.
Wow, I learned something here.
There you go.
So I have seen, I don't know if it's a trend or it from like large agriculture operations to your home garden, people talk about no-till gardening, which means not turning over the soil, just keep on amending the soil, it just doesn't seem to work for me. I have raised beds, and I've talked about this before, but my raised beds, the soil is already at the top, and I plant garlic, and it's a huge nitrogen feeder, and I want to put some manure in there, and I can't, and I'm like, I feel like I'm not allowed to lift the soil up to mix the manure into the soil. Does that violate the no-till thing?
Theoretically, it does, although scratching it into the top, I think, is acceptable with the no-till thing. What else are you growing in your raised beds other than garlic?
Dahlias, mm-hmm. And beans and potatoes and lettuce.
Okay. And how deep are your raised beds?
They're about 14 inches high.
Okay. All right.
And they're planted on top of what's grass. So,
I just want to talk a little bit about no-till, because I think no-till is so interesting, because it was not that long ago even 2 decades ago, when I was first starting to get into gardening, there were still a lot of people who believed that the only way to start a garden was something called double digging, which was this terrible back-breaking process where you dug everything down like at least a foot, and you'd turn it over, and then you'd dig something else back into it. It was so laborious. And now, of course, the sort of fashion is exactly the opposite thing. Don't touch it. Don't disturb it. And it does tell you, one, I think it's a good sign that, to remember that the science is always changing and we're always learning. But two, also that, there's probably middle ground on all of these methods that probably ends up being okay too.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for listening, everyone. You just solved it. We have to fill 30 minutes here, Aaron.
No, I have more ideas, because I do think the no-till thing is I like no-till a lot, and I more or less do it in my vegetable beds. But sometimes it's like you gotta, I don't understand no-till for potatoes, because basically the process of like digging up a potato is essentially tilling, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. or doing what they're saying you should do. Now, the whole concept, for anyone who's not familiar with it, the general concept of no-till is that by allowing your soil to create its own sort of microcosm and all this fungi that works really well and holds the soil together, you get a healthier, biodiverse soil, and it leads to better growth and better vegetables. And also less work because you are not bringing weed seeds to the surface. So it is very good for not creating more work for yourself in terms of weeding. So I think those are the general tenets of no-till. Am I missing anything there?
No, and I think basically the idea that sticking your pitchfork or your garden fork into the soil and turning it over is the mycorrhizae, or these organisms that have these little networks of tiny little roots, as they were, or, you know, bacteria that are linked, you're screwing that up.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So here's my concern. I've been pondering over your raised beds, because we've had this conversation before, because I always talk about how I always have to top up my raised beds, and you have the opposite problem. And what did you fill your raised beds with originally? When you first made those raised beds, what did you fill them with originally? Do you remember?
Dirt my neighbor gave me. Some of it was great. Some of it was bad. I didn't have a lot of compost or anything. I think I put some wood chips in and some manure. But it was mainly a topsoily garden mix. My neighbor is a farmer guy here, so it was good stuff.
Yeah. So it just seems so strange to me that, I mean, normally when you've got organic matter, and I know that you put in a lot of that manure for at least in your garlic bed, you know, normally when you put in a lot of organic matter, that organic matter continues to decompose, and that's how you end up with your soil level going down, but yours doesn't go down. Now, maybe it's just that you're adding in so much every year, which is not a bad thing necessarily. But things grow well in your raised beds, right? You don't have any issues with things not growing well, do you?
Well, in the past year or two, actually, things haven't been going really well. And I realized that I haven't actually been adding in like manure and stuff into the soil. I was just throwing out a little bit of a time release fertilizer. And I think my soil might be toast at this point.
Yeah, so that's what I'm wondering. So can I make a recommendation? You probably won't follow up, but maybe you will.
I do whatever you tell me.
No, you won't. Can you get a soil test?
Yes.
I think you should do a soil test. Send it off. There's a bunch of different ways to do soil tests. There are now some companies that you send it off to. I just do the University Extension Soil Lab, or the public university soil lab in my state. I'm sure there's one in Connecticut that could help you out, or New York, wherever.
Yeah.
And there's some directions usually on a website on how to do that. For here in Wisconsin, I think it costs $15. But what you can do when you send in a soil sample is tell them what you're trying to grow, and then they come back with recommendations for what you should be adding to your soil. But I think it would be interesting to know what the organic content, because that's one of the numbers that they come up with, is what is the percentage of organic content in your soil. And it'd be interesting to know that. Then once you get a soil test result back, and as soon as it's thawed out, I would send it in, because the whole world does it all at the same time, so it can take a little while. Then I think maybe you need to think about, because this problem's been going on. We've been talking about this for at least a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you should fix it, even if you don't do it in every bed, but at least for a couple of beds. Try to fix it once and for all by digging out a lot of soil. Since that's what you're doing anyways, you're faced with having to dig out soil to add in the amendment that you want to add in. I would say dig out a lot of soil. And then go and then take a look at what those recommendations from that soil sample are, and add in that along with, lots of good organic material like compost and, leaf mold if you can find it, or have some, or whatever, all those good things.
Yep.
And hopefully, ideally, you can just fix this kind of once and for all. And then going forward, you can just refill your beds once a year to supplement what has further decomposed, and then you don't have this issue that you're dealing with right now where you don't have enough room in your beds to actually put something in there that you need to, those amendments in there.
All right. So when are you coming over to start working on that?
Well, see, that's the problem, isn't it? But how does that sound? Does that strike you as not something you're interested in, or what do you think?
No, it's fine. I can use my little tractor, actually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good. That's perfect.
Just pull up the backhoe and dig it, scoop out some scoops, throw it in my trailer.
Right. Move it, put it somewhere. It's not a bad idea. But I think you should, that's why I think you should invest in the soil test. Which is not really a huge investment other than basically waiting for some time and whatever. And then just try to nip the problem in the bud, because I think you might be right that maybe your soil is just kind of kaput, you know? And that's not to say you can't revive it. You absolutely can. But digging out enough of it that you can fix it. I wouldn't say all of it, certainly, but dig it down deep enough that you can fix it with what needs to be fixed in there. And yes, there's definitely tilling and disturbance going on, but maybe 2-3 years from now, maybe you're at that point where you don't have to no-till. But like I said, I also subscribe to the idea that you do what you can do, and I don't believe there is, you know, you have to be totally stringent on these rules, because if we were, we would still all be double digging.
I remember double digging. I double dug some beds in the community garden in Brooklyn, and that was hard because you would hit brick and cement.
Oh, God.
Because the community garden was built
on a... Well, I mean, it's no wonder that people didn't want a garden.
I'm sorry?
It's completely understandable that people didn't really want a garden, because if that's what gardening was, why would anyone choose to be into that? You know, there's no reason to make it so hard.
Well, the community gardens in New York City mostly were built on buildings that had been pushed in, had been bulldozed in the 70s. And I have photos of it, actually, of it. It was just concrete rubble, and they put dirt on top with raised beds. And you can still, when you dig down, you hit brick.
That's wild. But isn't it cool? Because think about how much has been grown in those community gardens.
Oh, yeah.
Extremely well. I mean, it just proves that it doesn't take much to grow something.
Hey, would you be interested in supporting the show and getting some behind-the-scenes stuff that I don't share out to the general public? I've talked about Patreon before here. It's a program where it's kind of like the PBS model of a monthly support. So I'm asking for a cup of fancy coffee a month, if you'd like to consider that. And in return, I share with you sometimes stuff 4 times a week. Sometimes it's once a week. It just depends on where my brain is at. But I'm looking at the posts I've done recently. You can get them by email or on the Patreon app. The Patreon app is a much better experience, I think, but also by email. First of all, you get an after show for every podcast. So whoever I'm talking to in the show, we usually want to talk about something else and it doesn't quite fit into what we're talking about. So we do it as the after show for patrons. And something I just posted to the Patreons, to my patrons, I found Garden Fork episode number 101 yesterday, and I posted it for patrons, which can be listened to in your podcast app. So the after show has its own unique RSS feed that you can plug into your podcast player, whichever one it is. And so in addition to the regular show on your podcast app, the after show shows up as well. So, and my phone just shut down. So nice. A post called Donut Alone Time. There's a picture of me feeding the Labrador some breakfast. A picture of Andy staring at the camera. I got my ATV, my quad, stuck in the snow, and I took some pictures about how I got it unstuck. Progresses on editing I'm doing. I do some screen snaps of the edit screen, and like the donut show, I did a little screen grab of my editing. Talking about where to find the serial number on an engine, stuff like this. So, yeah, cup of coffee, Aren't I the greatest promoter of my own show? So, cup of coffee a month. There's links in the show notes here. Or go to patreon.com/gardenfork. That's patreon.com/gardenfork. All right? Thank you. Well, speaking of growing, I got my Fedco seed order a couple weeks ago, and I was Aaron. I ordered ahead of time. I was like, I had my act together. And then all of a sudden, yesterday, an envelope came from Fedco, and I'm like, I didn't order more seeds. And it was my two packs of super sugar snap peas and a letter from them about the routine germination testing of sugar snap peas. We discovered the germination rate fell below our standards. The federal minimum germination rate for peas is 80%. Fedco Seeds germination rate standard is always 5 percentage points higher than the federal minimum. For peas, we set this at 85%, and this particular lot's germination test came back at 78%. Huh. And it says, as required by the Federal Seed Act, we test our seed every 6 months to ensure the particular lots we are selling exceed the federal minimum. The Federal Seed Act also determines the allowable minimum germination rate of each vegetable seed type. And it says, because we care about your growing success, we're including a replacement order of super sugar snap peas. You may keep the previous seeds, share with a friend, or grow yourself for a few extra tasty snappy peas. And that's from Ryan Mitchell at Fedco Seeds. I didn't know anything about germination rates in the federal law.
I knew a little bit about them. But I just have to say, I think that's really, I mean, I know you really like ordering from Fedco. And I mean, I think they deserve huge props on that because, yes, there is, seed companies are required to meet a certain germination rate. I'm a little surprised that it's only at 80% for peas. I think it does depend on the crop, if I'm not mistaken, or the plant. I'm surprised. That seems low to me for a set germination rate. But, I mean, I think that's amazing that they went out of their way to spend the money to ship you those seeds. That's, I mean, without you even, you know, sometimes companies will do these things and send you a note, say, let us know if you want some, or we'll give you a discount or whatever, but they just did it, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, it's a seed co-op, and I've been a member of three different co-ops, and they are full of very interesting people, and you kind of have to all agree. So
yeah,
sometimes you're like, why are we doing this? Who has the talking stick? You know, and there are always some people, which is the polar opposite of me, but they want to do everything exactly the way the instructions say. That's not me.
It's not me either.
Instructions are optional for me.
Right. Right.
So,
well,
you know,
I think that's really cool that they did that, and sent you those, and you know, actually, if you buy a pack of seeds, most seeds will have a guaranteed germination rate on them. And I believe that that is one of the things that's required by that seed act. But I don't know who all falls into that category because, of course, there are very small seed sellers out there. And I'm sure they don't do, any sort of germination testing that is, you know, related to the federal government. So I don't know how all of that works, but I was aware that there was a federal, I guess I didn't know there was, it was called the Federal Seed Act though.
Yeah. Those draconian federal government people are prying into our lives.
I bet you that Federal Seed Act has some history to it. I bet you that's one of those things from like a long time ago.
I actually love sugar snap peas, and I've read in too many books and websites where they're like, you can plant them right in the snow. They're a cold weather crop, and that does not work.
No, that doesn't work at all. I love sugar snap peas too. I don't care for snow peas, the flat ones, but but right, I love sugar snap peas. And they almost never make it to the house. I mean, I don't know about you, but I almost always just stand there and eat them in the garden. They're one of my favorite sort of snacking vegetables. In case you were curious, the Federal Seed Act was created in 1939.
Oh. All right.
There you go. That's your little bit of... It is an act to regulate interstate and foreign commerce in seeds, to require labeling, and to prevent misrepresentation in seeds in interstate commerce, to require certain standards with respect to certain imported seeds, and for other purposes. So there's your little Wikipedia version of the Federal Seed Act.
People are probably arguing about the Federal Seed Act still.
So when do you start your peas? Because there is, by the way, a... is sort of funny. There is this kind of it's not a motto, kind of an adage that you start your peas, plant your peas on St. Patty's Day, which does not work here at all because our ground is frozen on St. Patrick's Day. Do you know when you usually start your peas?
When the soil is loose, about 3 inches, 2-3 inches down.
Yeah.
I just go out in the yard, and if I can stick my finger in, I'm like, oh, I'll put some in. And I overbuy sugar snap peas because I'll sow a row. I always do them at the end of the raised beds, and I have trellises at the end of the raised beds. And then a couple weeks later, I'll lay another line of them in right next, you know, a couple inches away from the ones I just planted as a backup. Because if we got a frost or I did something wrong or...
You know, that's such a good idea. But I bet normally you get all the peas from both of those rows most years, I bet, right?
Well, now that I'm going to have my brand new soil, it's going to be like crazy town.
Mm-hmm. So. Absolutely. No, that's such a good idea. And I think peas are one of those things that's a really good thing to succession. So now do you plant peas in fall as well, or have you not done that?
I do it, but I always miss the date. There's a date in August that you have to have them in by. And then they don't fruit because a frost hits or something. So I'm trying to get better at that.
That's exactly the same thing that happens to me too. I have a very hard time planning for fall crops. I'm very good at planning for spring crops, but planning for fall crops is really difficult for me because there's something about that mindset, especially in August. I mean, we're in high summer in August. So this idea that I'm going to do anything, think about fall and get things in, very hard for me to sort of wrap my mind around. So I almost always miss it too.
Well, we had a really warm fall and until recently a very warm winter. So I think I'll be a little easier. It'll be a little easier to get my second harvest there.
Good. That's good.
Last week was 50 degree days here. So the sap, maple syrup, the maple, sugar maple sap was running like crazy. I'm helping my friends boil who have like a big sugar shack this year. I'm not going to run my own evaporator. But tonight it's supposed to go down to 9 degrees and that makes the sap stop running. So it's, and the sap season, what I thought was very interesting is I get it's called the Maple News. It's a newspaper for the maple syrup industry. And a lot of news sources like that seem to dance around the climate crisis. And they're literally saying in the articles, hey, the sap season starting earlier and earlier here because of the warming, because of the earth warming. And I'm like, wow, it was kind of neat to see that. Because yeah. With the bees and the syrup, I've noticed that every year. I'm like, it's getting, you know, the bees can be out longer and my sap season starts earlier and earlier. There were some people tapping in late January here. So that's 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh, that's wild. Well, we've been having those crazy temperature fluctuations. I mean, everyone seems to be having it, in particular this year. I just noticed that all over. So we're 10 degrees today. So today I went out and sowed the last of my poppy seeds on top of the little bit of snow that we got last night. And then tomorrow it's going to be 47 degrees. So tomorrow I'm going to prune my hornbeams when it's nice out. So in one weekend, I'm doing two jobs that require, you know, completely different weather within, you know, 24 hours of each other.
So I like to watch YouTube. I don't know if you like to do that, but like at the end of the day or at lunch, I like to just prop up my iPad and watch something that's, you know, 7 to 15 minutes long. And I really enjoy a lot of the stuff that's on there. The problem is with the YouTube is what bugs me is the algorithm. If I watch, I'm doing a deep dive on these father and son who bought a short line railroad. And unfortunately now YouTube shows me a million more railroading videos. And I'm like, you know, I just want to watch this one thing. So at the end of the day, sometimes after about 6:30, I don't do anything computer related. My eyes hurt. I don't post anything on the internet after 6:30 because that's usually when I make mistakes. And I was kind of toast and I thought, you know, maybe I'll just ride my exercise bike and watch Masterclass instead. So yes, we're talking about Masterclass again. They made me an affiliate, which I'm really flattered by. And so we'll talk about it here. Here we go. I've been watching, hold on, I have his page open right here. It is Chris Hadfield, who is from Canada, and he is he's a retired NASA astronaut now, but he has a master class on what it is like to become an astronaut. And I've watched the first two lessons, and I'm overwhelmed already at the amount you have to know. It's amazing. And what I really like about it is Chris is literally sitting in a chair, a comfortable chair with a nice background. It's got rocket models and stuff in the back and warm light, but it's just him talking. I mean, yeah, there's a couple of graphics, but I really, really enjoy it. And I'm like, okay, so instead of me watching some DIY guy try and maybe be funny with his dogs or something and it's not working, I'm actually learning something here. I'm not watching a reality show on a channel and, like, you know, where they set up these fake tension, you know, shake, or one of those real estate shows. What's it called? House Hunters or whatever. That stuff is rather choreographed, let me just say. This is a person who has gone to space 3 times, former test pilot, now astronaut, wicked smart, but very approachable. And that's the approachable part here is important for me. So if you're interested in Masterclass, it's a bunch of classes by wicked smart people that are great at teaching. And I'm really enjoying the Chris Hadfield one. It is 7.5 hours long. And yeah, it's a little pricey. It's about $15 a month, I think. But it's a learning experience. Anyway, I'll stop talking about it. But we have a link in the show notes here if you're interested in learning about Masterclass. All right, back to the show. You know, real quick, before we end the show, I would like to talk about seed scarification, because I don't think everyone knows what that is. And why sometimes maybe there's seeds that they, especially natural wildflowers, where they don't grow the first year. They're like, what's going on here?
Right. Yeah, so many, you're right, that a lot of things that we think of as sort of self-sower type things, a lot of those are adapted to require a certain amount of cold period. So if they don't get that cold period, they don't necessarily die. They just might not germinate until next year after they get the cold period. So yep. Now there's some question apparently whether these, when I posted something about these poppy seeds, I did have somebody who literally, well, Matt Mattis, who you might know. I don't know if you've worked with him or not, but he literally wrote the book on flower gardening. He's wrote a book called Mastering the Art of Flower Gardening. And he contacted me. He said, you know, Aaron, he said, there is no real evidence that Papaver somniferum, which is bread seed poppies, the ones that we eat on our bagels and our bread and we all grow, many of us grow, require a cold period. He said, but it doesn't hurt. So I'm like, okay, I'm going with it doesn't hurt. But there are plenty of plants out there that need that on their seeds. So you can either get that by, you know, sometimes you can sow them directly as they would sow themselves. Or some people do this winter sowing method where you sow into like milk jugs and just set stuff outside. Or the other way to do it is sometimes is to just stick them in your fridge. Right now I've got like 4 packets of seeds in my fridge for a certain period of time. And then you bring them out. And that sort of gives them a false sense of winter. And then you can bring them out and sow them and they will hopefully happily germinate.
Wow.
Yeah. It's one of those things that I think that's why, especially when you get into flower. I mean, a lot of vegetables are very similar in the way in which you sow them. But especially when you get into flower growing flowers and grasses and things like that, sometimes you just have to do a little bit of research on how to grow that particular thing because they all have very different requirements and it's very hard to sort of lump them into groups and say, oh, well, this one you do this for. I think so. Hopefully you get really good seed packets that just have that information on there. But I look up at one point I have looked up almost every flower I grow from seed in some resource somewhere to get a better idea of what I need to do to make it work.
Huh. Yeah, I learned about it from, I was growing purple coneflowers from seed.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I put them in the fridge in some, I don't know, sand or peat moss or something. Or you could use paper towels and they have to be in there for 30 days or something.
Yep.
That's how I became an expert. Yeah, and that's the thing.
And some of those seeds need a moist cold treatment and some just need cold. And so that's why you just have to do a little bit of research. I know that... you know, like some growers will sow things in big trays in like a hoop house, an unheated, this is in the Midwest, an unheated hoop house. So they will get their cold, moist treatment in those trays and then they will sort of naturally come out of dormancy. Yeah. And that's great if you have a cold hoop house that you can do that in, which most of us don't.
No, but we're working on it.
Right. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, great. Thanks. Thanks for taking the time. Oh, you're going to stick around with me for the after show.
Absolutely, I am. But we will have to have maybe a follow-up podcast when we talk about what you're doing to fix your soil, right?
Yeah, I'm going to make a video about it too.
I want to see, I'd be really interested to see the results of the soil test. Cause I think those are always, soil tests are interesting to me. And I love the university extensions cause they're so good about, or the universities, the publicly available testing facilities are very, very good about knowing specific to an area what can be done. And I usually tell them that I grow organically to make sure that whatever recommendations they give me, they know I'm only interested in organic instructions or products. So,
cool. All right. If you guys have some thoughts about this, it's radio@gardenfork.tv. And if you're curious about how I cured my back pain with a tennis ball, that's what we're going to talk about in the after show for the patrons. There's information about becoming a regular supporter in the show notes below. All right, so go out and do cool stuff if it's not too cold and make it a great day. See ya. Garden Fork Radio is produced by Garden Fork Media LLC in Brooklyn, New York. Our producer is Sean O'Neill. If you need an amazing podcast producer, visit Sean's site, seaninbrooklyn.com. That's Sean, S-E-A-N, in Brooklyn.com. Our executive producer is Jimmy Goose. For more information about Jimmy and the custom hollow books he makes, visit hollowbooks.com. The music in the show is licensed from audioblocks.com and uniquetracks.com.